and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has mapped the furthest corners of the earth, not only geographically, but imaginatively too. She's a writer, professor of creative writing, and a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. Born in Nova Scotia and now based in London, her career has taken her from Antarctica to Africa, Greenland to the Falklands, with stops at some of the world's great universities along the way. A poet, essayist, novelist, and travel writer, her work has been recognised with awards from the Banff Mountain Festival to the Governor General's shortlist, and she's curated exhibitions on landscape, climate, and even Walter Benjamin. Her latest book, Latitudes, takes us on a deeply personal journey through the Anthropocene, one that's as lyrical as it's urgent. Well, that is my scripted introduction, and I have to go off script now to say that I read, I don't know, 4 or 5 books a week. This one has knocked me sideways. It's on a sentence-by-sentence level. Honestly, I think the best thing I've read this year. It's absolutely extraordinary. And so I'd really, really want to extend a hugely warm welcome to the incredibly talented Jean McNeill. Welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you, Georgina. And that is the most wonderful introduction I could have hoped for. It's actually given me a little bit of chills because, you know, as a writer, of course, this is what you want. It's not about impressing people or dazzling people with your amazing command of language, but it's about writing well, you know, which is hard. It's hard to write well consistently on a sentence by sentence level. So that's really, really good to hear.
Thank you. Every single word here is just pinpoint perfect. And there are phrases in here that make me want to go back and read them again and again. And you absorb their beauty in different ways each time. And you take us on this natural journey, this geological journey, this landscape journey, and describe colours in a way that I have never seen them or heard them being used before. It just is quite extraordinary. We've known each other casually for quite a long time, but there, it turns out, so much I don't know about you. And I want you to take us back to Canada. You were born and brought up by your grandparents. Tell us more.
Yes, I was. I was brought up in, I would say, the real wilderness. And actually, I'm probably the last generation of person in Canada to have lived that kind of backwoods life. Some people still live it, but modern technology, modern convenience has pretty much killed it. So from scything our own hay to making everything to having a garden where we lived off the land completely, hunting, shooting, fishing, trapping, that was our lives. And it was as if, you know, we were living 200 years ago. So sometimes in jest I say to people, I feel like I've been alive for 500 years because technologically I have. It was a real pioneer backwards upbringing. And in the case of where I come from, Cape Breton Island, I actually grew up on an island in the middle of a salt sea system. So the salt sea system is a lake, mostly saline, but 25% freshwater. And so you're on an island in the middle of another island, which is not attached to a peninsula, which is jutting out into the Atlantic. So it's a very, you could say it's a very precarious and very unusual, like geologically or topographically, it's a very unusual formation. There's not very many of those in the world. And we were, you know, living, I would say we were comfortable on it in a certain manner, but we were also fully exposed to the elements. You know, if you went out on a trapping expedition and you got it wrong and a blizzard came in and you got disoriented, which my grandparents, their contemporaries, probably wouldn't have done because they knew the land well enough. But, you know, you could die. And it was, and the winters were fierce then. And they still are intermittently. And so it was a kind of wilderness upbringing that I struggled to integrate when I did encounter the modern world. You know, it was really very strange. And also I was alone with the animals and my grandparents. So that was my upbringing. And it's sort of a quasi-foundling sort of, you know, you bring yourself up and the wilderness brings you up too. And so for me, because I spent so much time alone, I think that the land became a sort of surrogate mother and father, which I also didn't have at that time.
And of course that resonates throughout the book, and we'll get to that. But I mean, you tell wonderful stories about learning to read from the numbers on bullet cases.
Oh, yeah.
And being tied to a tree while your grandfather rescues a half-frozen wolf.
Yes, yes, that was kind of par for the course, actually. It really was. Like I say, that kind of life, you would frequently, you know, when you weren't killing animals, which I never had a stomach for, frankly, you were trying to do the right thing, you know, trying to live together in hospitable scenario. And I'm making it sound like the Arctic, but, you know, Canada's much more wild than Europe. Mm. And so even though we were near civilization, you know, in 40 minutes, you were in a town, it didn't really feel like that. And so it made an impress upon me, which I suppose I'm, you know, the paradox is I live in London. I'm a big city person. I'm a metropolitan. I love living in the city, but I've never really got this echo of that sort of lonely communion with place out of me. And so I recognize it whenever I see it elsewhere. And Latitudes is a little bit about that.
So how do you go from this very rural, very technologically backward lifestyle to working in publishing?
Yeah. Well, that's because I'm lucky enough to be Canadian. And, you know, social mobility in Canada is pretty good. And by the time I was 19, I was working, and I was still in university, actually. I got a very good job at the top publisher of the day, what went on to become Knopf Canada.
And that came out of you being a waitress, and one of your clients had a job going.
Well, I must say I have to thank Louise Dennis, who has just retired and stepped down from being a very important figure in Canadian publishing, and her partner of the day, Malcolm Lester. They gave me a job. Yes, yes. I mean, but that kind of thing, I suppose, that's what can happen when you're in a country when people aren't too fussed about, you know, which university did you go to and what kind of accent do you have? You know, I'm really lucky in that respect. But I don't know, I was also a bit of an alien. Obviously, I went from rural poverty. We were pretty much welfare class. We weren't earning money, you know, not much anyway, to being at the height of sort of cosmopolitan Toronto publishing of the day within, you know, 19 years. Yeah. I did do that.
Squiring
quickly.
Michael Ondaatje around and doing, being with all these famous writers.
Well, that's why I'm in Britain. You know, Michael is Canadian, but I loved working with all the authors, but the British authors were really fun and so engaging, and I just loved hanging out with them, and that's kind of why I'm here.
So how did you go from backroom, so to speak, to writing yourself?
I decided to give it a go, from working in publishing. I just thought, this is such a wonderful way to be in the world. I didn't think about it as a career or even in terms of prestige or ego or publication. I just thought that those people who I met, and I was lucky to, at a very young age, meet the top writers of the day through working in publishing and working on their books and squiring them around. But I just thought, these people meet the world with an independence of mind and a kind of tenacity and a certainty and an expressiveness that I thought, well, this is the way to live. Clearly, this is the way to live. And I was lucky in that I discovered, yes, I did have a kind of facility with expression and language. You know, I think I do. And I'm not saying, therefore, I'm putting myself on a pedestal, but it's something that did kind of come naturally to me. And I don't know why, because certainly in my upbringing and my education, it didn't look too good for me. But I found that I could write. And then, of course, the main question for you as a writer is not how do you write one book, but how do you have staying power? And how do you keep that conversation going, which is a conversation with existence, both your own existence, but actually collectively exist, how we exist, and also to an extent a cosmological aspect of it. You know, the how do I keep that going? How do I keep this kind of tumult of ideas and concerns turning over within me? But what I always admired about writers and what kept me going was, as I say, the importance of knowing your own mind. Because I think there's so many manipulative social pressures and factors on us. We're all being herded into categories and cul-de-sacs. And I absolutely refuse to allow that to happen to me. And I think through writers and reading, writing, imaginative writing in particular, people can regain their own sense of their sort of inner mental and psychological sovereignty, you know, through language.
And that's absolutely what it appears you're trying to do through this book. You're trying to connect with yourself, but also with the earth, with nature, to try and make sense of it all. So you end up doing travel writing. You're visiting various countries in Central America. Then you're in London. And then, and this is a job you still hold now, you're teaching at the University of East Anglia. Now, this is probably the best writing programme in the country. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I must say I was very fortunate that through a random encounter a long time ago in a garden party in Norwich in 2006, someone said, oh dear, we need someone to teach this module on short stories. And at the time, I'd just published a collection of short stories, which had been received really well. So that's how I got my first kind of toenail in the door, really. And through an unmeteoric rise, I'm now the director of the program some time later. But I've been the director of the program now for about 4 years. And the thing about UEA is it has a reputation. So it's not like being director of any other program. You know, you have the kind of cultural clout that other programs don't have because we've had so many excellent writers come through our program and be associated with it. So it's like being, I don't know, there's an aspect of being prime minister. It's like you have to step up to the mark. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about you. It's about the legacy, the heritage, the forward projection of the power of the program. So I don't teach as much as I might, actually, because I'm busy running things. But when I do teach, it is wonderful. It is really because our students are so good. Because of the prestige and the reputation of the program, we just get some very, very good writers. So I have to say I really enjoy it. It's almost like having peer discussions on one level. So, yeah, it's a fantastic job. But there's an element of cultural diplomacy about it, which I really enjoy.
The program's just a year and people come out of it at the end basically having done their first novel.
They do. It's a kind of accelerator. That's what I say to people who apply. I say, well, you know, they could just go and write a novel on their own. But through peer discussion, meaning workshopping, as in having people talk about your work in real time, your work in progress, people seem to learn and change and morph at a kind of accelerated rate, in my view. So what might take you 5 years working on your own, sitting in your garret, as writers used to do, kind of painstakingly trying to learn the ways of characterization. People pick that up within, you know, 9 months. Yeah.
So, I mean, the question always is, can you be taught to write?
I'll counter that with another good old adage about creative writing. People say it's about teaching people what not to do, you know, like don't change point of view within the sentence because otherwise, you know, you'll just confuse things. But there is an element to teaching people, yes, what not to do and teaching people certain fundamentals of craft and technique. But I think my private, assumption is that what people actually really get out of it, at UEA in particular, is coming and spending a semester or a year with real live writers. And through the teaching, they get a sense of what I myself encountered all those years ago working in Canadian publishing, which is what it means to be a writer in the world, which is to me, you know, like I said, an independent consciousness on your own track, wanting to transform nothing into something and nothing being ordinary, inchoate experience. So I think that's what the students get from us. They realize that they're among unusual consciousnesses. And they learn through just being with a writer as much as everything else that we actually do teach them. Can you teach a kind of natural facility with language? And some people seem to have an almost innate understanding of, say, how to write fiction, which is hard. Fiction, you do have to learn things to write it well. Yes, I would say there is an element of, in that case, you can't teach it because they already have it. And what about people who don't have that? But you can certainly make them aware of how hard they have to work, perhaps, to get it. Yeah.
Let's go back to your own creative work. So Ice Diaries was kind of your big breakthrough, wasn't it? How did it change you, not just as a writer, but also as a person?
Well, you know, yeah, by the time I wrote Ice Diaries, which was published in 2016 in North America and 2018 here, so a while ago now, nearly 10 years ago, it was my first non-fiction book. I'd been writing fiction and poetry, and that was my default kind of frequency. I went always to fictionalizing things. And it was, so something I had to learn myself was the way in which one portrays an experience which has actually happened, and people who really do exist, and how you respect the boundaries. But meanwhile, tell a story that's true, you know, and authentic to the experience. So that to me was a big learning curve, sorry for the cliche. And it was interesting to see its success in that I think people really do like nonfiction because it is based on, you know, reality, so to speak. And they find it very enlivening to read about one's own experience in this. Sorry, I'm saying voyeuristic, but I'm voyeuristic too. You know, I like it for that reason as well. It's like, how should we live? How do we live? And writing about the Antarctic gave me a fantastic frame in that my purpose, my mission was to write about that continent and the polar regions generally, because I was impassioned by the, well, by their existence and the necessity to preserve their existence. And so it was easy. I wouldn't say it just flowed out of me, but it was easy. But I would say its success is partly because people do find nonfiction very beguiling. Yeah.
So that came out of lived experience. You actually joined this exhibition. You lived in Antarctica. Another place that you went was the Falkland Islands. And they don't sound very nice. And the people there sound, well, it sounds like it developed over a long time, but the people there now are kind of driven by money and it's not how it used to be. You've got wonderful character in there, a woman that you know who tells you about living there. And it's very moving to read. But so is the journey there. You're on a ship, and you're on a ship. Everybody else is there because they have to be. Mm. And you have chosen to be on the longest, most boring voyage.
Yes, that's right. I am a masochistic gene comes to the fore. But just briefly, in slight defense of the Falkland Islands, yes, they are. I mean, the Falkland Islands are unique. It's totally bizarre. Everything that happens there is totally wacky. And the people at that moment in time, yes, there was a bit of a gold rush there. But I don't think that characterizes, you know, the islands forever. But yeah, you're right. So, yes, I joined a ship and it's something of a punishment journey. It's known as that in Antarctic circles, in which the ship, from having been in the Antarctic summer, very busy in the Southern Ocean, has to return to the UK. And on this journey, on this transect, we left Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands and we ended up in Vigo in northern Spain. And all of that took just under 4 weeks, I think.
And it's at bicycle speed, basically.
Bicycle speed, about 16 knots, yeah. The ship can leg it and do 20 knots if required. But mostly, you're inching up the coast of Brazil, basically forever. Brazil's very, very big. So this part that you've asked me to read is, and, you know, people listening might think, oof, this is a bit of like a heavy description. But actually, you know, the fact is some of the things you see at sea are indescribable. So I tried. Writers are like pilots. They like challenges. You say to a pilot, you know, get that airplane down in terrible weather on the ice runway. And they're like, yay, you know, they want to go for it. And writers are absolutely the same. So I thought, okay, let's give this a go. So yeah, we're on a ship and we don't have much entertainment on the ship. So every night, in lieu of doing, I don't know, playing backgammon, everybody assembles on the bridge to watch the sunset with their sunglasses on in silence. So you imagine this is the scene. The sun disappears, dissolving into the lip of the land. Its vanishing ignites an amber firestorm. This explosion imprints shapes in the sky. A feather, a hammer, a conch shell, the silvered silhouette of a fish. These shapes are stable only for a few minutes before mutating. The clouds press down on the sea, narrowing the depth of field between them until the horizon begins to pulse, pounded by an invisible instability. White gold flutes of light fan into an indigo sky, knife straight. But soon these throb and dissolve, and fire embers, recalled to their source, now plunging westward across the Amazon and into Peru. A red meridian is etched across the sea like a brand cauterizing the night. The officers call this the aftershock, and it does the job of aftermath, hurrying us into a pensive, chastised mood at the sheer lavishness of its desolation.
Ah, and the sheer lavishness of the description. I mean, just extraordinary.
Well, like I say, don't worry, the whole book isn't quite like that, because a lot of people say, oof, you know, purple prose. But actually, like I say, you know, sometimes you just have to get between the moments and try to interpret the meaning of what you're seeing. Often you're seeing things which are totally spectacular.
There's one point where you say there's something I can't describe, and then later you mention that indescribable thing that happened, and you never, ever say what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you do lay down your tools, actually, and say, okay, I'm out, you know.
So I have to come to the most surprising thing about you, for me to find out, was that you then went and trained to be a safari guide in Africa, in South Africa, and in Kenya. Now, this is not just about pointing out what kind of zebra that happens to be. You have to learn how to shoot a charging elephant. You have to learn the names of all the birds, all of the plants. You have to learn a lot about, I don't know, the gestation period of a giraffe and so on. What on earth? I mean, this came after you walked across the Namibian desert. Is there some kind of self-punishment thing going on here? I mean, does it go back to what you were talking about, needing that solitude and also needing that space, that time to just make sense of everything and to find out what it is that the earth is trying to tell you?
Yes, I have to say, it was, I did, you know, really take it very seriously. I did qualify professionally. I've got the actual certificates. And so I meant it. And I would love to work in the bush, for sure. But I did it, yes, in service to the final thing that you mentioned, was that I thought, okay, I need to learn this land. I need to learn this landscape, because I was spending a lot of time in Southern Africa and I felt a very strong natural affinity to the whole place, you know, the culture, the land, everything. And at that time, you know, South Africa was kind of my home. And I thought, well, I need to know this place. I need to know the land as well as if I'd grown up here, if I can possibly, because in Canada, I had a similar sort of knowledge. But it's very different to be born and brought up somewhere and have that embodied knowledge than rather go out and get it in this sort of boot camp quasi-military fashion, which is safari guiding. And it was tough, there's no doubt about it, but it has to be tough, because if you're going to go out there and put your life at risk and other people's lives too, and the animals' lives for that matter, you have to really know your stuff. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be able to almost read the air. And I found it thrilling. It was just, I'm afraid the SWAT in me loved it, because I wasn't actually, you know, I wasn't the best student. There were some natural geniuses there who just like, they barely had to look at the books, you know, and they could write the exam. But I just loved, I love learning. You know, that I have to say is something which I can't explain to you. And not in that sort of, oh, now I'm so intelligent, now I can tell you all this information, boring way, which people find really tiresome. But I just thought, I want to be able to translate this experience into literature, but into something that's that other people can enter, you know, without going on safari, because you have to have a lot of money to go on safari. So I thought, I must write about this place so that it becomes accessible and meaningful to other people who can't go there. And so that I can unpack or explain my weird affinity with the African bush. You know, I'm not African, I'm white. That puts you in a very problematic position with vis-a-vis knowledge in Africa. So let me work this out. So that's why I did it. But I did it for about four or five different reasons. I was also researching a novel at the time, which I did publish and write, called Fire on the Mountain.
Which was set in Namibia, but was never explicitly set in Namibia.
It's a kind of post-colonial everywhere it's set in. But yeah, very much it was inspired by both Southern, you know, South Africa and Namibia. And so part of it is what I call expeditionary research, which as a writer, sometimes you have to just go out there and do it yourself and to be able to write the book that you want to write. And even if that means putting yourself in peril or, you know, kind of boring journeys where you want to fling yourself off the ship because you don't know who you are and why you're there. I mean, it's very, very uncomfortable psychologically as well as physically.
And I mean, you really go into it. There's something so self-revealing about it. There's intense joy, but there's also grief. How do you balance all of that?
Well, I think grief is a really hard thing to write about because it's a downer. You know, everybody shies away from it. And it's a very, very, it's one of the hardest things that we'll ever experience in our lives. But I think for me, look, I've been alive now for 55-ish years. In my lifetime, the planet underneath our feet has changed. It is no longer the same planet. I don't think that's happened before. I mean, yes, it might have happened before in deep time or dark time when we weren't around. But I just think it's kind of my duty in a positive way rather than a sort of punitive fashion. It is my duty to try to think about, okay, what does it mean to be alive in this, I think, what will be in the future, very key interregnum of 50, 55 years when we could have done things, obviously, to arrest, you know, climate change. And I called my book Ice Diaries, as you mentioned, the Antarctic book, and I wanted to call this Anthropocene Diary. There's two ways you can say the word, Anthropocene, Anthropocene, Anthropocene Diary. And nobody would let me, not my agent, not my publisher, nobody would let me, because it's such a, it's a chilly word, and it's also a word that makes us feel instantly guilty, culpable. And but that's kind of what it is. I've been lucky enough to be in some of the world's great wildernesses. I put myself there deliberately too, for 50 years, and I just thought, okay, I've got a story to tell about what I think the planet is saying to me in a fanciful way, admittedly, but I really do think I can sometimes hear things, and I really do feel I have that kind of communion with the Earth. And I can't really describe that except by writing about it in this way, using myself as a sort of prism, if you will, as a vehicle for that dilemma of what is the planet trying to tell us.
You say the planet on which I came to consciousness is not the same planet I am on. That planet is gone. Where do we live now?
Mm.
And, I mean, do we know the answer?
Well, we live in a planet which I think has its own destiny, quite separate from us. But I don't think it will recover from us for a very long time, if ever, no matter what happens to us. And, you know, that species-wide civilizational consciousness of being a civilization that is doing this is, I think, a game changer. I think, again, human beings have never confronted that before. Maybe in a, you know, other kind of mass extinction sort of scares like nuclear war. But basically, we've never thought of ourselves. We, I think, are beginning to understand who and what we are. And it's a very profound consciousness change for humanity. So again, you know, this sounds really quite heavy. What I was aware when I was writing the book was that I wanted it to be a pleasure to read. I wanted it for people to pick it up and think, oh, well, this is quite a bouncy travelogue. But to be honest about the sort of things that I was feeling in the shadows as I was doing this, and as my knowledge of the world has amassed, you know, my concern and my understanding of our moral debt, I guess, to existence was becoming stronger. But I do hope it's engaging to read, and it's not a kind of, I'm not trying to tell us off for merely existing or merely moving. You know?
Yeah, it's definitely not a climate polemic. Do you think, finally, really, that writers have a responsibility to engage with climate collapse, or is witnessing enough? And you've done a huge amount of witnessing. I mean, you are showing us things you have seen that many of us will never, ever have the opportunity to see.
Yes, I think, again, I do believe in moral duty. I actually really do. I believe in it in an individual sense and also in a sort of civilizational sense. We have a duty, not necessarily to ourselves, but to the planet, as the planet is a kind of deity and everything that surrounds it is on that level of unknown force. We don't really know what's put us all here. And so I do believe in that, yes. And I do think that writers, they often can't intervene, whatever that would look like. You know, all that's required really is for a few hundred thousand people to stop investing in oil, you know, and to make a real change. You know, it's not huge, but writers are not in charge of the Gulf States oil production. So what we can do is provide a witness account of what it was like to live now. And I use the past tense deliberately, not what it is like to live now, but what it was like to live now, because the now is accelerating so quickly that it's always going to be a rearview mirror in a way that didn't apply before, I think. And again, you know, this sounds tragic and overbearing perhaps, but I really don't think so. I think that the fact is writers bring inanimate things alive, so-called inanimate inanimate things alive, like rocks and trees and, you know, your day last Tuesday. You know, writers, that's what they do. They consecrate experience. And I'm going to disappear, but I wanted to leave something behind in that usual kind of way that we, I think we all do.
It's a really brave examination of self, of humankind, but ultimately it's this beautiful love letter to the earth.
Yeah, it is. It really is. I realized that in finishing it. I thought, that's what I've been doing. Because in some ways, I thought I was writing a book about climate change and other people have done that better than me. And I didn't quite do that in the end. I thought, well, then what have I done? And I realized that, yeah, for me, you know, because of the way I was brought up, the landscape really was mother and father. So in, you know, a kind of, I hope it's not sentimental, a deeply, deeply felt way, that's how I've ended the book, which is back to where I started. It ends where I began.
Well, Jean, it's absolutely beautiful. Jean McNeil, thank you for talking to me. Latitudes is published by Barbican Press, and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the producer, Steph Chungu, who also edits the programme. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.